Good evening, everybody. My name is Debbie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Debbie.
And I guess the format is to give our sobriety date. My sobriety date is September the 23rd, 1986. And it's a privilege and an honor, and I am truly humbled to be here tonight to have been asked to participate in this Florida State Convention. I've been to some conventions. This is my first time speaking at one, and I was asked, was I nervous? And I said, no, but that was then, and this is now. I'll just try and remember what my sponsor taught me, and that is that there are those who love me, and they will love what I say no matter what. There are those who don't like me, and they're not going to like what I say no matter what. And the rest of you aren't listening. So really, it's pretty simple, you know, ultimately to come up here and share your story, because it's my story, and the purpose is to hopefully instill hope to someone who is still suffering. You know, I went to a meeting as a newcomer, just like we all did, that first ever meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I felt like so alone and so isolated and so desolated by my disease. And I walked out of my first meeting with just a glimmer of hope. And that's what we give. We share our experience, strength, and hope. And that's why I'm here. You know, I had a sponsor who instilled service and more service. And when that didn't work, get into service. You know, it didn't really seem to matter what I wanted to talk about, but we talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. We talked about the traditions. We talked about the importance of the steps. We talked about going to meetings, that the power is in the meetings. There is a power in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that does not exist anywhere else on the planet Earth. It's not in the parking lot before the meeting, although there's a lot of power there. And it's not in the parking lot after the meeting, although there's some kind of power out there, isn't there? But it is within the confines of the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because just as tonight, we are all here focused with a higher purpose, you know, recovery from a deadly disease. And my story starts a long time ago, obviously. I'm no spring chicken. I happen to be from Miami, born and raised here, grew up here, back when it was a simpler place. We didn't have to lock our doors in the middle of the day, you know. I grew up in the South Miami area and went to school here. And moved when I was 19. I made my first geographical when I was 19. I'm like the lady in the big book. It talks in the big book about how sometimes alcohol seems to take women down pretty quickly. And it sure did me. You know, I was a pretty good kid. Really, I was. I was pretty good. Until my senior year. I'm a late bloomer. I was a late bloomer in many ways. And my senior year in high school, I started drinking. So I was 17, really, when I started drinking. And by 19, I was driving down the road, contemplating suicide with a car full of empty beer cans. I couldn't figure a way out, dropping out of college, and getting ready to move. It really didn't take very long for me to lose hope. And it didn't take very long for my life and all my dreams and aspirations to turn into dust. You know, it was just a couple of years. And everything after that revolved around drinking. I didn't realize that then. And let me qualify my story tonight. I didn't know anything about anything when I was out there doing it. Everything that I share with you, everything that I have come to see, everything that I've been awakened to has been a result of the grace of God, His turning the light bulb on in my life, the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, outstanding sponsorship, being allowed to sponsor some really awesome people, and continued one day at a time effort to do this program. I didn't know I had a problem drinking, okay? I was 17, 18, 19, and I drank, you know. I went to the frat parties, just like other people did, and we drank. I mean, that's nothing unusual about that. But I can look back today, and I realize that my drinking was not like everybody else that was at the frat party. You know, not everybody laid on the ground with their mouth open under the tap. Most of them used a glass or a cup or something like that. Not everybody needed to have 2 to 3 drinks to get to the frat party. You know, I used to have to drink to get going. And I remember, I'm going to jump around because that's what I do. My first wedding anniversary, I'm dressed to the nines. I got a long evening gown. It slid up to the side. I got that long hair done up, makeup on, passed out cold because I got drunk trying to get dressed. You know? And I missed the whole thing. I missed the whole event, you know. My husband was not real happy with me. But I didn't have a problem because there were other people there drinking. You know, I mean, you go to a frat party, people get drunk. That's what you do. I mean, it's like a challenge. How much can you drink? And I just didn't realize I had a problem. I didn't realize that the fact that after 6 months or 8 months, I would walk away from a job and get in my car and move was a symptom that I had a problem. I just thought I was, you know, like that's what everybody does, right? The boss is getting ready to fire you, so you quit. I was never fired. Never. Never fired, but I always quit right in time. Right in time. And then you load your car and you go somewhere else. You know, and that's what I did. And I did that from 1969 until 1974. And my drinking was, of course, escalating because that's what it does. My tolerance for alcohol was getting worse. You know, when I was a new drinker, you know, a baby as it were, I could drink a lot. I mean, copious amounts, a lot. And I was very proud of that. And I used to place bets in bars with you big guys, you know, that I could outdrink you because I usually could, you know. And what I did. And it was always good for free drinks. I was saying something to somebody earlier, you know, like, I didn't have to pay for booze. Come on, I'm a woman. You guys were always willing to pay for my booze. You know, you're very easy, you know that. And especially in a bar. It's real easy to get free booze in a bar with it, especially the bars I went to, because I'd find the salesman-type bars, you know, the traveling salesman-type bars. They had their plan, I had my plan. You know, and I would always leave out the back door of the bathroom right when things were getting too cool. But, you know, so I drank, and I didn't see anything wrong with it. I was in pain, okay? I am the person in the big book. I always felt separate and different. I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't think that I needed to present something to you that I knew in my heart of hearts did not exist, okay? That's from as far back as I can remember. But I didn't know that that had anything to do with my drinking. I didn't think about my drinking. I drank, okay? The only time I thought about my drinking was when you asked me why I did what I did the night before. You know, it's like, wow, Debbie, why'd you do that? It's like, I don't know. But, wow, you had a lot to drink, didn't you? I said, well, it wasn't that much, you know. Well, why do you drink so much? Well, then I have to come up with a reason, you know. So, of course, the reason was you. It was always your fault. You know, because you did things to me that hurt me, and I drank at you, and because of you, and in spite of you, and any other way you can think about it. That's the way I looked at it. You know, if you had my parents, you would drink. If you were had my sister, you would drink. If you were related to my brother, you would drink. And God knows if you were married to my husband, you would have drank. You know, there's no two ways around that. You would have drank. And that's really, honestly, what I thought. I honestly spent my life thinking that my drinking was a result of circumstances, situations, and environment. I really believe that. I had no idea that this was a disease. I didn't buy into it. I thought it was an excuse. I thought it was a cop-out that people that got in trouble, you know, that got the DUIs and stuff, I thought it was something that they pulled out of the hat so they could get a slap on the wrist, you know. I didn't use that when I got my DUI. I just, you know, did the thing and went to the class and got the slap on the wrist. You know, I had my DUI way before they started getting serious about it. And I was aggravated when I got it, to tell you the truth, because I wasn't that drunk, okay? I'd been much more seriously drunk behind a wheel before then. And truly more seriously drunk behind a wheel after then. That was like I barely was warmed up. And all I did was back up into a state trooper, okay? That's all I did. But he had no sense of humor. And the next thing I know, I'm blowing in a tube and I'm posting bail. I mean, you know, it really aggravated me. But I got back to him. I got my revenge later on, and that was in my ninth step. I've been making donations to the Florida State Patrol Trooper 9 for years now, trying to make up for what I did to the guy's car. But, you know, so I didn't know why I was drinking. I just knew I was drinking. And there's something magical about a drink, isn't there? There's just something about a drink of alcohol to us. It is awesome. It changes the world. That hostile world is no longer hostile. You know, that person you're with is all of a sudden better looking, better, more attractive, especially about 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, everything's better. You can dance when you had a drink, and you can't dance before you have a drink. You can shoot pool when you have a drink, but you can't shoot pool before you drink. You know, you can have sex when you have a drink, but you can't have sex without a drink. I didn't figure that out till I got sober. I remember sitting in a meeting saying, "You want me to do what, sober?" I don't think so. You know, this ain't happening, man. I can't do this. That's probably why I'm divorced. I don't know. It could have something to do with it. But my drinking, you know, it got worse. And you know what happens, or what happened to me? Somewhere in our literature or at a meeting or somewhere I heard it and I believe it, you know, we're bankrupt idealists, you know. And I had high ideas and I had high values and I had high plans and I principled. I was a very principled person, you know. I had lots of principles. I don't know about you, but every other thing out of my mouth, well, it's the principle, you know. You shouldn't treat me that way. It's the principle. And I had a lot of principles when I was young. I really thought, I was born in 1950, so this will qualify some of this. I really thought that a person should be a virgin when they got married, and I really thought that you should wait a few years before you had kids. I really thought that I was going to go to college and graduate. I really thought that I would be married 5 years before I had children. I really thought that you should be faithful to your spouse, you know, that infidelity was a horrible thing, and I had lots of principles. But then I drank a lot of beer, and I drank a lot of vodka, okay? And then the 70s came. And we went from Donna Reed to make love, not war, and have orgies and whatever else was happening, you know? And my mind just couldn't handle the shift, you know? So I was like this. I had these two roommates, and I was 21, and they thought there was something seriously wrong with me because I was still a virgin. And there were no surviving virgins at 21 back then because it was the 70s. You know, I think it's a miracle now if we can get them to 16. You know, but so they just, you know, Debbie, you got to do this, you got to do this. I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, give me a date. You know? And that's putting it euphemistically, a date, you know. That's making it real pretty. So they call this guy, you know, and he picks me up and it's like, okay, we're going to go to the movies. And he said, do you want anything? I said, yeah, I need some beer. So we got he bought me a six pack of Tall Boy Colt 45 malt liquors. And I'll never forget that six pack. I will spend the rest of my life trying to forget the sex, but I will never forget that six pack. You see, that sexual experience was pretty typical of my entire life. I built up, because see, I was a virgin at 21, so I built up 21 years of fantasy of what it was going to be like, you know, and it wasn't like that. It wasn't, and it was, all I could think of the next day was Peggy Lee's song, "Is That All There Is?" But I was drunk and inexperienced. He was drunk, and I don't know how experienced he was. And we were in a car, for heaven's sakes, you know. But a funny thing, it wasn't really funny. A strange thing happened to me the next morning. You see, I had violated one of my fundamental principles. So I came to covered in shame. And it was the first time in my life I had truly tasted shame. You know, throwing up at a party is one thing. That's embarrassing. You know, falling down the stairs at a frat party is embarrassing. ripping your pants or whatever. That's not finding your clothes. That's embarrassing. But violating a fundamental principle, I felt cheap and I felt dirty. Now, it was easier to have sex the second time, and I didn't as consciously feel the guilt and the shame the second time, but it was there. And I began building a layer of what we ultimately come to of complete demoralization. Every fundamental principle and belief system that I had, that I believed that a human, decent person would live by, I violated before I got done drinking. Every single one of them. Every single one. So I'm like, going out there and doing my thing and blaming you or not even thinking about it. I was single. I could do what I wanted to do. And I landed on the west coast of Florida in 1972 or something in there. 73, somewhere in there. And one of those principles I had was to not date married men. And I wound up dating three at the same time. And that'll make your life unmanageable. I guarantee you. Well, one of them actually went and got a divorce. And I actually married him. And he was going to save the day. He was going to fix it. He thought that, and I thought that. I just thought, I'll be normal, and we'll all just live happily ever after, or whatever I thought. I don't know what I thought. I was drunk when I got married. What the heck? Well, I know. I started drinking at 9 o'clock in the morning. The ceremony was at 2. You can figure the rest out for yourself. I don't know why I got married. I was scared. That's why I got married. I was scared. And I liked him. I did actually like him. We would have been probably good friends. Horrible married, but we probably could have been good friends. So I got married, and nothing happened. I just kept getting drunk, and all of a sudden he realized that I drank. I'm not quite sure why he didn't realize that before when we were at the bar, but he decided that he didn't think it was good for me to walk in the door and pass out at his feet. And I guess he didn't notice that before we got married. So I started to try and control my drinking, and that's the first time I really started to try and control my drinking. And we had a heck of a time of it. So much of what we did revolved around drinking, going to places where people drank. And so I was constantly embarrassing the man and myself and just getting in all kinds of trouble. When it says in our literature we have the innate ability to get drunk at exactly the wrong time, we do. I don't know what the right time to get drunk is, but if there is a wrong time to get drunk, we can do it, without a doubt. And I remember one party I went to, I was dancing with someone, not my husband, and we were doing the bop, which will date me again. And this guy, twirled me, and I got, airborne. And I landed on my eyebrow, which, of course, created copious amounts of blood flowing. And for the next 4 days, all I heard out of my husband was, "I've never seen anything like it." Yeah. "You didn't even put your hands out, Debbie. You just..." It's like, "I don't even remember flying. Why would I put my hands out?" So that was embarrassing to him. It was embarrassing to me. It got the guy in trouble with his wife. And, so this was, and I quit working. After we were married 2 years, I quit working. So I sat at home and drank. That's what I did. And I share this every time. I sat on a couch and drank for at least 10 solid years. That's what I did. My bar days were gone. He frowned on that. So I drank at home. And it wasn't pretty. And it started to progress. And it took less and less booze. And more trouble would come. And I would feel worse and worse and more alone and more isolated. I decided at some point in time that I should have a child. Because, the marriage was going so well, let's have a child. No, I think that biological thing hit. It's like, oh, you got to have a baby or something, And we tried, and it wasn't working out, and then I got pregnant. And I was sitting at home watching Phil Donahue, and I knew that I shouldn't drink. And I knew that I shouldn't smoke, and I knew that I shouldn't eat red meat. I knew I shouldn't have, caffeine and all that stuff. And I continued to smoke, and I continued to drink. So I didn't enjoy my pregnancy. I lived in fear that I was going to have a horrible, deformed something, because we don't have little things, we have big things. you know, were extremists. I couldn't just have a healthy child. I was going to have a damaged child. But I couldn't stop drinking, and that was the first time I began to become aware that maybe the tail was wagging the dog here, because I really didn't want to drink. You know, I really didn't. But I had my first child, my daughter, and thank God she was awesome. She was okay. You know, she was perfect. And so unfortunately for the second child, if the first one was okay drinking, then the second one you can drink more. Right? Because they don't know what they're talking about. You know? So 2 years later, I got pregnant again, and I was carrying my son, and I started having problems. And I wound up in the hospital for 8 weeks. It was like a real bummer. I felt fine, but I was having trouble, and so I was on bed rest. And I was in there for 8 weeks, and they said, okay, if you go into labor, you can have the baby. It's like, okay, good. So I forced myself to go into labor. I locked myself in the bathroom. I did jumping jacks, and I started bleeding, and they came in, and they took the baby's cesarean section. I had been in that hospital 8 weeks. I wanted to get out of that hospital more than I wanted to breathe. I put my life at risk. I put my son's life at risk, but I got out of the hospital. And 2 days later, I was home with my son, and 5 days later, I was at the grocery store buying beer and drinking. And I drank. And I'm not proud of this, but this is what I did. And this is what was beginning to tell me I had a problem. You know, I drank when I was pregnant. I drank when I nursed my kids. When I wanted to put them to sleep, I either gave them beer in a bottle or stuck some Sudafed Plus in the thing, because that always put them to sleep, because they would interfere with my drinking. You know, they would interfere in my drinking. And I remember going to a meeting and listening to someone very well-meaning, angry at her daughter who was drinking when she was pregnant. Angry at her. And I said, she's sick. She's powerless. Do you understand powerless? It means I have no power. I don't want to do this, but I do it anyhow. If I had the power over it, I wouldn't need you people. You know, think about it. I wouldn't have to go to these meetings. I could stay home. I'm powerless. I need help. But I didn't stop drinking. I brought my son home. I brought my daughter home. I wish to tell you, I saw the light and I quit drinking. I didn't quit drinking. For the next 2 years, it was absolute and complete hell. Absolute and complete hell. And my babies I would pass out in the living room, and my babies would crawl and sleep next to me on the floor. And I would come to in the morning covered in vomit with my babies next to me. And I didn't know if I fed them, and I didn't know if I cleaned them, and I didn't know if I changed them. I just knew they were there, you know. And we lived like that for a while. And the shame and the guilt and the anger. I was building this unbelievable anger because it was all you. It's not me. I'm not powerless. I'm not powerless. I can figure this out. I will figure this out. You know, I'm not going to go to those meetings. First time I called AA was in 1974. The first meeting I ever went to was 1986. Okay, it took me 12 years to get in a car and actually go to a meeting. I was a little short on action. I was a little short on willingness. I was a little short on humility. I didn't have what it took to be a member, you know. I didn't have what it took to get in here. I hadn't hit that point of surrender yet. My husband moved to Miami. I'm in Arizona. I got my two babies. I got a stepdaughter. She hates me. I hate her, so I figure we're even. But that was great, man, because she could watch the kids. And I was drinking 7 days a week. 7 days a week. I sold the house, and I had to get in my vehicle and move to the Keys. And I've never had such a long, painful, frightening, terrifying trip in my entire life. I landed in the Keys in June of 1986. I was afraid of me. My children were afraid of me. My husband was afraid of me. Everybody was afraid of me. And I knew I had to go back to some semblance of controlled drinking. I thought I could go back to some semblance of controlled drinking, and I was wrong. It took me 3 months of absolute and living hell before I surrendered. Every morning I got up and I cried. Every morning I got up and I didn't want to drink. Every morning I got up and I got in my car and I took my children to daycare. I didn't work. I just got them out of the house. I felt safer if they were out of the house because I didn't know what I was going to do to them. I remember coming out of a blackout, standing on a chair or on the bed with my hand back with a belt in my hand and my daughter in absolute terror in the corner, coming out of a blackout like that. So I got them out of the house. I got them away from me because I was so angry. My life is out of control. The more I try and control it, the more I try and manage it, the more unmanageable it becomes. I'm a horrible person. I'm a horrible mother. Everybody's telling me. If you loved your kids, you wouldn't drink. If you loved your husband, you wouldn't drink. If you loved yourself, you wouldn't drink. And I'm going, what? Just leave me alone? You don't understand. You don't understand anything. Nobody understood. But I called Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1974. I was drinking. My sister had kidney failure. All kinds of stuff was going on. And for 12 years, periodically, I would call you fine people. You know, I'd like to think it wasn't wasted. I'd like to think when you got off the phone with me, you said, there but for the grace of God go I. I would like to think that some of you just went to your knees in absolute gratitude. Thank God that's not me. Thank God that's not me. And I know I talked to a lot of newcomers because I would get really drunk before I'd call y'all. And some of you would actually talk to me for hours. And I know you had to be newcomers because an old-timer wouldn't have talked to me that drunk that long. They wouldn't have done it. They would have said, go to a meeting, you know, or we'll come and get you. But I got to the Keys. I'm dying, man. And I think I'm trying to make that decision, you know. Do I just pack the bags and leave? Do I end it all? Or what am I going to, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I don't, you know, our books are fascinating things. They're a living document. They are me. They are you. They are all of us. But when the most profound thing any of us ever says about any of this stuff is something happened, you know, when we are at that turning point, the best we can come up is something happened, you know. One day I was this way, and now I'm that way. Something happened. You know, it's like we're the most mystified people on the face of the earth. One day I woke up, or came to, which is a better way to put it, the same way I had for thousands of days. Helpless, hopeless, powerless, cloud of doom and gloom, knowing the day's going downhill. And I get, you know, and I get up, and I get my kids, and I take them to daycare. And I go, and I stop, and I cry, and I buy my first can of beer, and I started drinking, just like I had for the 3 months that I'd been in the Keys. And I drank, and I went into a black place. And there, it wasn't a blackout, because I vividly remember it. It was a black place. There was absent of light. There was no life there. It was just pitch black and a scream. The only thing there was a scream. And I don't know how long I was there. I don't know how long the scream lasted. I don't ever want to go there again. And when I came out of that, I was standing in my kitchen. I had a phone book in my hand, and I was looking for the telephone number for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was having a hard time because I never knew how to spell alcohol very well. I couldn't find it, but I found the treatment center, or whatever it was, there in Tavernier. And I called them up, and they said they could see me on Friday, and this was like a Tuesday. I said, you don't understand. I am made it to Tuesday. You know, I got to talk to somebody today. So they made an appointment for me, and they told me to call the Isla Mirada room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they gave me the telephone number. So I called, and this wonderful gentleman by the name Carl answered the phone, and Carl talked to me. And he told me when the meeting would be, that the next meeting was going to be at 8 o'clock that night. And did I want him to send some women to my home? And I said, don't send no women to my home. I don't want no women in my house. You know? And I said, I'll get there just fine. Don't worry about it. So he gave me directions. And I called my husband and I said, Terry, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And I'm going to go to an AA meeting tonight. I'll see you later, clunk. Because I was scared he'd try and talk me out of it. And I proceeded to drink the rest of the day, and I called every alcoholic person I knew and told him that I was an alcoholic and I needed help and I was going to an AA meeting that night. I didn't even know what I was doing. I was carrying the message. Yeah, didn't even have a clue. And I stayed on that phone until 6 o'clock when my husband walked in the door. And the reason I know that's a long-distance phone bill stopped at 6. And I hid from him, and I bathed my kids, and I took a shower, and got dressed, and didn't drink, you know. And I get in my car, and I'm going to go to Islamrata, and I'm going to go to this meeting. And I had to go by the Circle K, and I made it by, because, man, I am thirsty. It's been like an hour and a half since I had a drink. I got by the Circle K. I got by the town site, but I couldn't get by the trading post. That car just whipped right on in there, and I bought a can of beer. Bought a can of Bush beer. And I went outside with my little brown bag, you know, so nobody knows what you're doing. And I popped that top, man. Now it says that we are restless, irritable, and discontented until the taking of the first drink. The sense of ease that comes with the taking of the first drink. By then, in my life, it wasn't the taking of the first drink, baby. It was a popping of the top. As soon as that sucker popped and I heard that sound, I knew there wasn't a power on the face of the earth between me and that drink. You know, and I popped that top, man, and I'm ready to suck this baby down. And these three guys are sitting there, and one of them says, "Can I have some money to buy some of that?" And as God is my witness, I handed him my beer. And I got in my car and I drove half a block to Islamrata Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was talking to Carl, Carl said, "I'll save you a seat and I'll be sitting outside for you." And I got there and there was this big old guy, about 6'4", standing outside. He said, "You must be Debbie." And I thought, how'd he know that? Probably because I looked like a deer pinned in headlights, you know. I was like, ah! Plus, I was the only drunk there, you know what I'm saying? And he didn't know it. He didn't know it. He didn't know what he did for me that night. In our preamble, in our how it works, it says, if you want what we have, then you're willing to go to any lengths to get it. That was the first example of something that I wanted. I didn't know I wanted it, but I knew I wanted it when I left there, only it took me months to figure it out. And you know what I'm talking about. I had not been able to tell somebody I would do something at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and do it at 8 o'clock in years. Because between 4 and 8 was a lot of vodka. And forget the promises. Forget the commitments. I couldn't tell my kids I'll take you to the park and 5 minutes later pull it off. You know? So just the fact that that man was sitting out there waiting for me impressed me. Only I didn't know it. You know? He began to wear down that wall that says, you don't understand, you don't care, you're just like everybody else. I'm in this on my own. I don't need your help. You won't help me anyhow. Screw y'all. And he began to tear it down. And I walked in there, and he sat me at a table, and he says, "How do you like your coffee?" And I said, "I don't like coffee." He says, "How do you like your coffee?" I said, "I don't like coffee." And I'm thinking, they don't listen real well in here, do they? So he brought me a cup of coffee. And I've shared this many times. It was the single most wonderful beverage I've ever drank in my entire life. It was the most awesome cup of anything I've ever had to drink in my entire life. It was made with love. It was made with acceptance. It was made with tolerance. It was made for me. This unlovable piece of entity that walked in the door. It was my welcoming into a home I didn't know I had never had, into a family that I knew I must be related to somewhere. I knew if I just held on long enough, I would find my true relatives. And I did, you know. So I sat in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you all shared what it was like, and it was a good old rousing first step meeting. And there were people in there, you know, that had 8 years and 10 years and 15 years, and I didn't know that. I didn't understand that. But you all said, "Come back." And you gave me a poker chip, and I wasn't quite sure what that was all about. And I bought a big book. And some of y'all gave me telephone numbers and said, "Give me a call if you're having a problem." And I walked out of there with some hope. And I got home, and my husband said, well, how was it? And I said, I think the hardest thing I'll ever do in my life is go back there tomorrow night sober, because I was terrified that my head would talk me out of going back. Because I walked in drunk, baby. I had to go back sober. And I didn't know if my insanity, I didn't know what it was, but I didn't know if my insanity would talk me out of it. And I was drunk, so I didn't hear that there was a 7 a.m. meeting. I missed that there was a noon meeting. I totally blacked out that there was a 5 o'clock meeting. I thought I had to wait until 8 p.m. to the next meeting. So I was terrified when I woke up the next morning. I didn't know what else to do, so I heard them voices. Don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book, and talk to somebody in AA. Well, I had a big book, so I read it. I read it that day. I sat in my chair and I read it. And there are pieces of that book that have been imprinted on my mind and in my heart since the day I read it, September the 23rd, 1986. My story is I walked in and I haven't had a drink since. That is my story. That was my bottom. I pray to God that was my bottom. I pray to God I don't ever have to go back out and drink again. What I was taught in here is you don't have to drink again. You don't ever have to drink again. You are not alone. There are people in here that will help you. It took me a couple of months to really understand the profound events of the last day of my drinking, to fully comprehend my trip to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to believe at about 2 months of sobriety when it occurred to me I gave away that beer. And I knew the definition of a spiritual awakening, that I could see, feel, think, and do that which I was unable to do on my own unaided resources. I was able to turn that drink away. And I had not been able to do that an hour before. That, my folks, is the great miracle of my life. That is the tangible proof that I have, not a philosophical idea, not an abstract concept. That is tangible proof to me that there is a power that has restored me to sanity, that will give me what I need every day, minute by minute, hour by hour. You heard the numbers, millions, billions. Sometimes it felt like a billion hours, didn't it? And you look at your watch and it was 5 minutes. It's like, Jesus. I'm never going to make it. Or you're at a meeting, you know, and they're talking, you know, them. We used to have this guy down in the Keys. Every time he talked, he'd bring up Admiral Nimitz. I don't care what the subject was, we had to hear about Admiral Nimitz. You know. But if you listened, he'd tell you how to stay sober one day at a time. Somehow in all that nonsense, he'd tell you how to stay sober one day at a time if you'd listen to him. If you'd open your heart, if you would practice tolerance, if you would listen to the tradition, the way in tail end of the last tradition where it says place principles before personalities, if you would just sit and listen and be quiet and open your mind and your heart, he'd tell you how to stay sober one day at a time. This was the sanest man in the Keys. He'd been released 6 times from the nut house. He had the papers to prove it. You know, I'd never been in a nut house. Nobody had ever declared me sane. But people, and I had a sponsor, man. She said, you get to that meeting, she didn't say it, she did it. You get to that meeting, you sit down, you be quiet, you listen. And when it's your turn to share, you share, and you share from the heart. You want to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, your time of getting has to be short-lived. You got to start giving back. And the sooner, the better. I remember her saying that when she was like 3 months sober, somebody drug her down to the mission district. And she said, well, I don't know what to say to them people. And old Vince said, don't say anything. Just say whatever you want. You're so pretty, they won't care. You know? And she said that used to say back then that she got sober, giving away what she didn't have to people that didn't want it. You know, I did a lot of things in AA, and I didn't realize I was doing service. I carried people to meetings. I was probably the only female in the Keys at the time that had a driver's license. Down there, first they take your driver's license away from you, then they take your bicycle away from you. And you're on foot, you know. But service was something that was important, and it's something we talked about all the time. I believe in my heart of hearts that I would have been sober today because I believe I gave up and I believe I reached out to a God of my own understanding, and that my power to stay sober comes from Him. But I know that I would not be the person that I am today, that I would not be the spiritual person that I am today, nor would I have the relationship with a God of my own understanding that I have today were it not for the sponsor that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous and the meetings that I went to. You know, I could not do this alone. I never would have understood this alone. I would have made this way too complicated. I don't know how many times she said, "Debbie, just give it a rest." You know, just give it a rest. Or nip it in the bud, she'd say. We gotta nip this in the bud. Just nip it in the bud. You know. Send your brain to the lab. This program is full of paradox. They tell you to hang in there, and then they say, let it go. And I go, do you want me to hang in there, or do you want me to let it go? I love this program. I don't know if that comes across in my talks. I am so grateful to be sober. I have such a profound faith and belief in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as the program of recovery. You know, and I cannot stress that enough. The theme of this conference is the steps we took. We take them one at a time. Sometimes we go two steps forward and three steps backwards, but we take them one at a time. I remember dear Mavis from the Keys. Took her 12 years to get sober, I believe, and stay sober. And she said she went up the steps, she fell down the steps, she was under the steps. But I believe this, and I believe this to the core of my being, that when you finally take that first step to the core of your being, without reservation, just like it says in the big book, you don't ever have to drink again. You may be nuttier than a fruitcake, you know, and you may try and two-step this baby, and you may get suicidal, but you don't ever have to drink again. Now, if you want to take the other 11 steps, you can have an awesome life. And you can join us on this happy road of destiny. And you will have things happen that you could have never imagined. I sat on a couch for 10 years. I had imaginary life. I had imaginary friends. I had imaginary lovers. Wasn't that a song, Imaginary Lovers? I used to have total relationships on my couch. I would see you from across the room. I would want you. I would go home. I would have a relationship. It would be awesome. They would write novels about it. We would have a fight. We would break up. And it all happened in an afternoon. But by the time I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was incapable of talking to anybody about anything. And the great absolute paradox of my life is that I can stand up here and talk to you. That I can stand up here and share with you. I was helpless, hopeless. I was a fall down, pass out, throw up, drunk, man. I was unloved, unlovable. I couldn't love. I didn't want to love. I was full of hate and anger and fear, and I was dangerous. And people didn't want to be around me. And by the grace of God and the steps that you taught me and that I have tried to practice for the past 14 years, I have stayed sober one day at a time. I have learned to love. I have learned to care. And I have learned to give. And I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak. I am truly humbled that I was given this opportunity. I want to thank you all very much for your kind attention.